Pleasure tonight to welcome you, members of the Institute and guests, friends, to hear a speech given by a native son of this province and a person who I like to call an old friend of mine, although we haven't seen each other for many years. My last acquaintanceship with Dr. Lamb was when he was librarian of the university library here, and I was one of the students who talked too much in the reading room. Dr. Lamb is a distinguished scholar, librarian, and archivist. He started his career as an archivist and librarian in Victoria for the Provincial Public Library. He then came to the University of British Columbia, where he remained until 1948, and then from there went to the National Library, and he was National Librarian, National Archivist in Ottawa for 20 years. During that time, when he became acquainted with the diaries, which you're going to hear tonight, and what is not generally known is that Dr. Lamb is one of the four literary executors of Mackenzie King, of the Mackenzie King papers, that he saw and read the diaries years before they came into the public domain, and that he discussed Mr. King's diary and other papers with him on numerous occasions prior to Mr. King's death. It's a happy coincidence that, which we didn't plan some months ago when we were lining up the speakers for our fall series, that at this time, Mackenzie King diaries are so much in the public mind and public press. It's my great pleasure to call upon Dr. K. Lamb.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I've been most kindly introduced, but unfortunately any of you who have seen page 6 of this evening's Sun will know my true character. And I presume in the course of the evening you will perhaps decide whether Mr. Justice Rutan is right or whether page 6 of the Sun is right. What I'm going to tell you tonight is to a great extent a personal story, and I think perhaps I can help best by telling you a little about my personal association with Mackenzie King and how it started. I was in Ottawa in June 1948. At that year, I was president of the Canadian Library Association, and the annual meeting was being held in Ottawa. And the Canadian Library Association at that time was just starting what has become a very remarkable project. It's microfilming of old and historical Canadian newspapers. And someone had the bright idea of microfilming Mackenzie King's grandfather's newspapers, the Canadian Patriot and the others. And then are you able to hear me now?
Better?
Good. Isn't it good yet? Make it a little shorter. A little higher?
We're not going to strike with you.
Oh, not quite.
They don't allow us to strangle you. They're turning the sound up back in the back room.
Is it any better now? Good. Well, someone had the bright idea that it might interest the Prime Minister, and incidentally interest him in the project, if they presented him with a microfilm copy of his grandfather's newspapers. And as president of the Canadian Library Association, it was my duty to visit the Prime Minister and hand over the film. And we had quite an interesting conversation. Microfilming was a relatively new thing to him. He knew very little about it. He was quite thrilled with the idea that his grandfather's papers had been copied and was very interested in the whole thing. And we had quite a discussion. Years later, Jack Pickersgill asked me to look up Mr. King's diary for the date of that meeting. And in Mr. King's diary, he said, "This is the man I think should be the next Dominion archivist." I went off to England to the university's conference with Dr. McKenzie and Dr. Shrum, who are both here this evening, and quite unaware of this little time bomb that was ticking away in Ottawa. Then in September, I got a telephone conversation, would I please come to Ottawa to talk about the position of Dominion archivist. Well, that's another story. I was not anxious to leave British Columbia. I was not anxious to go to Ottawa, but in the end, for various reasons, I decided to go, and I went. I saw Mr. King in September 1948. I knew he was retiring. I knew he would have retired by the time I got to Ottawa, which I was to do on the 1st of January. But what I did not know, and what he did not mention, was that his papers, lock, stock and barrel, would be in the public archives when I arrived there. Now, there are people in Ottawa who said that he chose me to look after his papers. Now, that is not quite true. But the fact is that when I got to Ottawa, here were the papers, and they were in the institution for which I was responsible. And inevitably, there was a personal relationship immediately between Mr. King and myself. He was going through a very difficult period of adjustment. He had been Prime Minister for years. Suddenly, he found himself just an ordinary Canadian citizen. He was talking to me one day and telling me how great the adjustment was, and I said to him, "Mr. King, I'm really not surprised, because weren't you Prime Minister so long that you just feel as if you've always been Prime Minister?" And he laughed and said, "Yes, that's perfectly true." I always remember that afternoon as he went out the door, he turned and said, "You know, I always feel better after I had a talk with you." So we had quite a personal relationship, partly about the papers, and partly just because I was a new canvas. He could paint any picture he liked on me, so to speak. And I used to be asked to go up to Laurier House for tea and to dinner and so on, and had a very interesting time. And I think in many ways, I came to the conclusion in the 18 months he lived after I went to Ottawa, I got to know him in a personal sense much better than many people who had known him for many years. I heard it said to Mackenzie King once that he said, "If you want to control people, keep them at a distance." And I think that was pretty true in virtually all his political relationships. He kept people a little bit of distance. Well, there was no reason why he should do that in my case. There was nothing political involved. It was a purely personal relationship. We were both interested in these papers, and that was that. He had intended to, as you know, to write his memoirs. And everybody was quite convinced from the start that he would never get the memoirs written. Mackenzie King, so far as I could discover, never finished anything unless there was a deadline. If there was a broadcast, his staff would be troubled with endless versions over and over again, revisions right down to the last minute, but eventually there came a time when it had to be accepted as it was, and there was a text. Well, there was no deadline for the memoirs, and we were quite convinced that there would never be any memoirs. And as a matter of fact, when Mr. King died, there virtually nothing had been done on the memoirs except a few notes about his own very early years and his own family. The person who worked with him in those last months was Fred McGregor. Fred McGregor had had an association with Mr. King going back to 1911. He had been his secretary, his personal secretary, from 1911 to 1925, which is a long time. And all through the period when he was in the United States during the war, when he was out of office after his defeat in 1911, up to the time that he became Liberal leader in 1919, and then right through to the time of the 1925 election. Fred McGregor saw him through that whole long period. And so he was working with someone that he knew well. This string is broken now. probably tie that up now.
It just somehow came undone.
All right. Now, the great problem with the memoirs was this. When Mr. McGregor used to try to urge him to do something, to put something down, to begin to get to work on a manuscript, he'd say, "Now, Fred, don't worry. The book's sitting there. It's virtually written." And he would wave his hand in the direction of the famous diary. And then the problem arose when Mr. King was no longer there. What about the diary and the instructions that he left it? Regarding it. Now I must tell you a little bit about my relationship with him, with the papers and the diary. I knew that he had said that he was going to leave instructions that it should be destroyed. He intended to use it for his memoirs and then destroy the original. And I was, as an archivist and an historian, was much disturbed by this. Now I remember one day, up in Laurier House, we were having tea and we were sitting on either side of the fire up in the famous study, the room, as people say, from which Canada was governed for 20 years. And I tackled him on the subject. And the diary was, he was on the left side of the fireplace, and the diary was all along, a whole series of little volumes and then loose leaf books coming up beside him in his chair. And I tackled him on it. And he said, "Oh, well, you know, it's the importance of this diary is greatly exaggerated." And he pulled out a volume and he said, "Now look here, this is my diary. When I was in London last October, remember I was sick there, I was in the Dorchester Hotel, and the doctor asked me to keep a record of my symptoms. Now what interest is there in this?" And he read me some symptoms. And then he said, "Oh, by the way, that was the afternoon that Nero came to see me." And then he read me his account of his discussion with Nero about what should be the constitutional position of an independent India in the British Commonwealth. And I let him read on, and when he was finished, I said, "Mr. King, do you seriously mean to sit there and tell me that a discussion between the senior Prime Minister of the Commonwealth and the Prime Minister of an emerging independent India is not of historical significance? I just don't believe you." And he said, "Oh, quite exceptional," and brushed it aside. But I think from that time it dated the qualification in his will that was so important in the years to come. He had intended to go through his diary and mark the passages that he wanted used or would use for his memoirs. And of course, he never did that. But nevertheless, the will said that the diary was to be destroyed except such passages as I have indicated. And that was the problem that the four literary executors met when they were faced with the diary. I'd like to tell you just a little about the diary. The diary covers 57 years. From September 1893 to 2 days before Mr. King's death in July 1950. There are some gaps. The most interesting gap is a gap from in November, December 1945, at the time of the Russian spy business, the Gozenko business. And it has always been thought, and these read many people think, that in some way the Russians wanted to secure possession of that part of the diary. And as you remember, the Royal Commission discovered that there had been a Russian agent on the staff in Laurier House. Well, now, whether or not that's true, the amusing thing is that the day that Norman Robertson came into Mr. King's office and told him about the Gozenko business, Mr. King started keeping a special diary on the Gozenko business, and that is there. So if the Russians were looking for the account of the Gozenko, they simply got the account of other things, and the special account of Gozenko is there to this day. Naturally, over 53 years, the 57 years rather, the character of the diary changes. It starts as a teenager's diary. It gradually works up to a young civil servant, then a young deputy minister, then a young minister of the crown. And then it goes on, it becomes in the war years. The climax comes in the war years, but it becomes an amazing chronicle, day by day, of what was going on in the war, the political problems involved, and so on and so on. During the war years, the diary runs to 1,200 to 1,300 typewritten pages, about 300,000 words each year. Now, I mentioned that it was typewritten. In the early days, it was handwritten, but later, when Mr. King was in office, both times he was in office, from 1921 to 30, and later from 1935 on, he dictated it. He dictated it as a rule in chunks of 2 or 3 days. And it was dictated in large part to Edward Handy, who was his confidential personal secretary, and a man who had in whom he had a perfect faith and a well-deserved faith. Handy was completely devoted to Mr. King. He had had a son who had been ill with a disease that would have been fatal if he didn't get treatments that Handy himself could not possibly afford, and Mr. King arranged for all the expenses involved, and Handy was his slave ever after. But Mr. King was an amazing reporter, a very accurate reporter. So far as interpretation is concerned, so far as judgments are concerned, they may vary, they may reflect his own opinions, his own prejudices, and so on. But insofar as facts are concerned, and he made the greatest effort to make his diary factual, time and time again we have discovered that it is amazingly accurate, just unbelievably accurate, because he would sometimes dictate pages and pages after 2 or 3 days had been passed. Yet he could recall a conversation in tremendous detail, and that can be checked in one or two respects. For instance, Angus MacDonald, later Premier of Nova Scotia and a member of the King cabinet during the war, kept a very detailed diary. And if you put Angus MacDonald's diary down and Mr. King's diary down, you'll find that the agreement on facts is really quite astonishing. It is just about as completely reliable a factual account, quite apart from opinion and things of that kind, that you would ever be likely to encounter. It is an amazing record, and I would like to quote a statement by Colonel Stacey, whose recent book has made quite a stir. But I know Charles Stacey as the official Army historian, a superb historian. I think I would go so far to say that I would think he was the finest historical scholar in this country. And this is what Colonel Stacey says about the diary. It is the most important single political document in 20th century Canadian history. It is also a social and a personal record of absorbing interest, chronicling in great detail and with sometimes shattering frankness the personal experience of one human being, and a very eminent one, from adolescence to the grave and from the last decade of Queen Victoria's reign to the Korean War. That reminded me of a statement made by Robert Latham, the editor of the latest and superb new edition of Pepys' Diary. Now, it may seem a bold thing to compare Mr. King's diary with Pepys' diary. So far as style is concerned, there will be no comparison. But this is what Robert Latham said of the Pepys' diary. If all records of his period, except this one, were to disappear, it would still be possible to reconstruct much of Pepys' world from that diary alone. And the same would be true of Mr. King's diary. Pepys' diary, by the way, only covers 9 years. We think of it as being a much larger thing than that. It runs from January 1660 to May 1669, but they were 9 very remarkable years. Just shortly after it begins, you have the restoration of Charles II, then you have the Dutch War, then you have the Great Plague, and then you have the Fire of London. An extraordinary 9 years. And if you take 9 years of Mr. King's diary from October 1935, when he returned to power, which good liberals would consider as a restoration of sorts, to August 1945, at the end of the war, 9 years and 10 months, you have the Great Depression, and you have the war. Fully comparable, I think, to the Pepys diary in the national importance and historical importance of the events covered. In his peak year, by the way, Pepys' diary runs to 201,000 words, that much the longest of the years. But as I say, in the war years, Mr. King's diary runs to about 300,000. Now, we were faced with the fact that Mr. King obviously wanted us to, the four of us who were responsible for the diary, or on all his papers for that matter, wanted us to have a biography written if he had not completed his memoirs. And perhaps I'll just take a minute and tell you about the four of us. The oldest, the person of oldest standing was Fred McGregor, whose acquaintance with Mr. King, as I've told you, went back to 1910, 1911. Secondly was Norman Robertson, son, of course, of the inimitable Lemmy from our own campus. Norman was in external affairs. Mr. King was Minister of External Affairs, and it was his habit to second people from external affairs to his own personal staff. And Norman was so seconded for quite a period. Jack Pickersgill has said that no one person had a higher degree of Mr. King's confidence in the whole last period of his life, and undoubtedly that is true. The third one was Jack Pickersgill. Jack joined External Affairs in 1937, was seconded to Mr. King's office in 1938, and began to assist with, in a small way, with helping with speeches and so on, and gradually worked up to, although he was never actually principal secretary, he was a person on whom Mr. King depended very, very heavily. And then I was very much the new boy. I had come, I had custody of the papers. The papers had been moved from the archives, and the diary was at Laurier House. But Laurier House, by Mr. King's will, came to the Government of Canada, and I was made responsible for it. So I was very much in the thick of things. Now, what were we to do about the diary? There were two possibilities right off the bat. One was, should we destroy it completely without reading it, without looking at it, and that was that. The other thing was, should we use it in the way that we thought Mr. King himself expected to use it? And when we looked at it a little, we just came to the conclusion, and I think all of us felt this, that total destruction was simply out of the question. This was a major historical document. This was a major diary, the like of which had not been seen before in the history of Canada, and it was unthinkable that it should be destroyed. The first biographer appointed was Dr. Robert McGregor Dawson. And the first question was, of course, should we give Dawson access to the diary? And we came to the conclusion that he should have access to the diary. What was the use of appointing a biographer and not giving him access to what the subject of the biography had considered the major source for the story of his own life, which the diary very much is? Now, recently there has been a charge made that the literary executors, who, as the Sun article tonight hints, were a very reprehensible lot, had not given Dawson complete access to the diary. That is quite untrue. The truth is that Dr. Dawson had not the patience to read the diary. He was working on the early part of Mackenzie King's life, and I don't know whether any of you have ever seen Mackenzie King's handwriting, but the whole of the first part of the diary is in his handwriting. It's terribly difficult, and practically the only person who could decipher it successfully was Fred McGregor, who had worked with him for years when he was working with the handwriting all the time. So what we did, at Dawson's insistence, and he says in the preface to the volume of the biography he wrote, that the executors undertook to put the diary in readable form. Now, were we going to make the whole diary? Were we going to decipher the whole tremendous diary or parts of it? And Dawson said he wanted the parts that related to public affairs. He didn't care about the rest. Just give me the meat of it that I can get on with the study, which he called a political biography. So that was what was done. Now, that is what Dawson used, but he was never denied access to the full diary if he wanted to use it. But he just did not do. He refers another place to the dreary job of deciphering the diary, which was just something that he himself would just never undertake to do. Well now, we had Fred McGregor deciphering the parts of the diary that Dawson wanted. We have a biographer attached, and all seems to be running along smoothly. So far as the papers were concerned, and they're a huge collection, Mr. King virtually never destroyed anything, and there's a tremendous amount of just straight superfluous stuff at Laurier House that there was no use keeping. I could just mention one example, Christmas cards. There were thousands of Christmas cards. Now, many of those Christmas cards were interesting. They were from interesting people, they had interesting inscriptions. Those were all kept. But the run-of-the-mill cards were thrown out. For instance, there were cards each year from the Governor General, including Lord Byng. There was a card from Lord Byng in December 1925. There were no cards from Lord Byng thereafter. So on. You have quite an interesting time. But even with all the winnowing and bringing things down, the papers as they still now exist in the archives take about 900 feet of shelving. That gives you some idea of the bulk of them. An astonishing collection of papers, and one of tremendous, tremendous historical value. Now, the sun is going to come into the picture at this place, this point. Because a certain Bernard Austrey has been, I'm told from a friend in the East, has been on either TV or radio, I don't know which, denouncing me and my ways, and Dalton Camp has taken up this story in the paper. Well, Dalton, an association between Dalton Camp and Bernard Austrey puzzles me a little, though I have heard that extreme left and extreme right are perhaps not very different. But anyway, be that as it may, there are certain things Dalton should have checked. He says Duncan McTavish was a senator. Duncan McTavish was not a senator for more than 10 years after the alleged encounter with Austrey. He says that Leonard Brockington was one of Mr. King's executors, which he was not, etc., etc. He also says that we did our best to prevent anybody else writing about Mackenzie King except Dawson. Now, that's quite untrue. I think it was in the spring of 1951 that Bruce Hutcheson came to see me. And he said, would you mind if I wrote a book on Mackenzie King? And I said, Bruce, good gracious, no. Two things, Bruce. First of all, I have no right to interfere with you writing in any way, and I'd be very pleased. Go ahead, surely. The only thing I can't do is let you have access to the Mackenzie King papers, because they are held by agreement with the biographer that nothing will be released beyond the date of the published biography. But beyond that, why, bless you, go to it. And as you know, that very amazing book, The Incredible Canadian, was published at the end of 1952. Now, appears on the scene, about that time, I forget the exact date, Bernard Austrey, who is talking here. Now, Bernard Austrey was Bernard Austrey came to see me, and the only thing he was refused, The only thing he refused was, just like Bruce Hutcheson, access to Mackenzie King papers. He came into the office and he virtually demanded access to them. And I said, well now, look, these papers are not owned by the government of Canada. They're controlled by literary executors. True, they're in my custody as Dominion Archivist, but what I do with them is entirely decided by the decisions of the literary executors, and that's that. I can't give you access to them. Then an unfortunate thing happened. Bernard Austrey went to look at the Laurier papers, and he wanted Mr. King's letters to Laurier. Now, Fred Gibson, now professor of history at Queen's University, is mentioned here. He was working with Dr. Dawson at that time. And he, unbeknownst to others of us, without any authority, without my knowledge, without the authority or knowledge of the people in the manuscript room, had taken Mr. King's letters to Laurier up to Laurier House, which he, of course, should never have done. We didn't know they were gone. Austrey looked through the Laurier papers and said there are things missing. And the boy in charge quite rightly said, no, there's nothing missing, nothing's been taken out. Well, Austrey had in some way discovered that these letters were at Laurier House. Well, all we did was phone and have them brought back, and that was that. Now, that is the extent of the story. And there's one more thing I want to point out. Mr. King left the literary executors his copyrights. Now, you know, if I write you a letter, you own the letter physically, but I continue to own the text. And Mr. King's copyrights covered the text of his letters in the Laurier collection, if we had chosen to exercise that right. In other words, we could have denied access to those papers, which we had no thought of doing. The only thing we were doing was following our agreement with the biographer that he would have first and while he was writing on the biography. And that is all there is to the Austrian matter. I might say that I think Mr. Austrey is the only person who has ever accused me of any shenanigans of that kind in 20 years in the public archives. So his charges really don't bother me that much. Things ran along very nicely. We came to the conclusion what to do with the Mackenzie King papers. In June 1954, we signed an agreement, the four literary executors signed an agreement to the Government of Canada that the papers would be transferred to the public archives, they would be put in the custody of the Dominion Archivist, myself, that access to them would be controlled by the literary executors, they would determine the terms of access, and the papers would become the property of the Government of Canada on the 25th anniversary of Mr. King's death, which was July the 22nd, 1975. Now, that was tidied up. Then we had two, I think I call them calamities. First one was Dawson's health began to fail. By about 1955, it was obvious that he was not the man he had been, the scholar he had been. And we began to worry about what was going to happen, were we going to have even a first volume. In the end, toward the end of his life, he had written the beginning of the volume and the end of the volume, and there's a hole in the middle, which is about as uncomfortable a position as you could have. But finally, the book was finished, and it was published just a few months after his death. Bob Dawson was the most likable and remarkable person. But really, it was very trying. I was always the one that had to deal with him, and it was pretty trying in the last years when he was not well, and when things were not going well, and he knew they were not going well. And if you look at the 7 years he spent in the first volume, the biography was advancing at the rate of 65 pages a year, which was pretty slow. The second thing that happened was this. I was in Paris. The archives has offices in London and Paris, and I used to go over sometimes to see what was going on. I was in Paris in September 1955 when the telephone rang, and this was Norman Robertson phoning from London. He was a high commissioner there. And he said, when are you going home? And I said, well, I'll be off in a couple of weeks. He said, well, I'm glad because The story goes that microfilm copies of the Mackenzie King diaries are being sold in Canada. So I came back to Canada and discovered that this was true. And it all came round, hinged upon a dishonest microfilm operator in the public archives. Dr. Dawson had insisted on having photostat copies of great sections of the diary, and this photostatting was done in the photographic division at the public archives. And while the photostatting was going on, the microfilming operator on the sly did the filming and then proceeded to sell copies of the film outside. Now this was a very difficult thing. People have asked me how on earth was it done. Well, at that time the people who were in the actual place where the photographing was done were just two in number, the chief photographer and the microfilm man. And I'm perfectly certain that what Jean Daviau, the microfilm operator, said to the chief operator was, "Oh, you go off to lunch, I'm just going to have a sandwich today." And of course, while he was having his sandwich during the noon hours, the microfilm camera clicked away on the King diaries. Now, all sorts of stories. There were a lot of stories about this microfilm diary a while ago. And what amused me was that it was always assumed that I knew nothing about it. Well, that was based on the assumption that if you know about a thing, you talk about it. If you don't talk about it, it's assumed you don't know anything about it. Well, I knew all about it. And there were only two difficulties. We didn't know how much had been filmed, and we didn't know how many copies had been sold. We know some copies. Jack Kent Cook bought one copy, and it's rather comic about that, because he bought it, and then he rang Duncan McTavish, who was his lawyer in Ottawa, to say, how about using this? Would it be all right if he went ahead and made something of it? And Duncan McTavish said, as a lawyer, I tell you no, and as one of Mr. King's trustees of his estate, I also say no. he had not known of that connection. In the spring, it was said that John Bassett had a copy. I know nothing about that. Peter Dempson, a reporter who died recently, who published a book of reminiscences, said that he had a copy for which he paid $1,000. I was told several times that Mr. Diefenbaker had a copy and that he was enjoying it very much. I've always longed to ask Dief about that, but I've never quite had the nerve. But anyway, the copies were out, and that was that. Now that enormously complicated our problem as to what to do, what was to be done ultimately with the diary. We had considered various things. We had considered destroying it up to a certain period, perhaps up to the time Mr. King became Prime Minister or something of that kind. I made experiments about pruning it. Going through and eliminating the chit-chat and the personal things and making it a diary of public affairs. There are two objections to that. It's always a subjective judgment by the person who does the cutting, and there's always the certainty that people will say, oh, of course, he's cut out all the scandal and all he's pruned away, he's made Mr. King lily white, all the scandals are out and everything else. So that's not very satisfactory. And the third possibility was to seal them for a good number of years until practically everyone who mentioned in them would be gone, and they could not hurt anyone in a personal sense. Well, the microfilming brought us up against the fact that it was not really feasible to destroy the diaries. It was not really feasible to prune them. For this reason, that someone had possession, we didn't know how many people, we didn't know how much, and to this day we don't know how much, had possession of large sections of the complete text. Now, if you destroy the original, you put those people in the case of being able to make perfectly, if they want to, perfectly imaginary quotations from the King Diary, and you can't deny that those passages are in the diary. You just hand a hostage to fortune in a way that you is just it's simply out of the question. And so we came to the conclusion that one way or another, the diary had to be preserved. And I may say that is the opinion of every historian who has seen it or worked with it at all. They simply say destruction of this document is simply unthinkable. It's simply could not be done. 1958 was a year of decision for us. The first volume of the biography was out. Dr. Dawson was dead. We had to consider the future. Our first step was to appoint Blair Neatby to carry on the biography. He had worked with Dr. Dawson a bit and was a fine young scholar in whom we had perfect confidence that he would carry on the work competently and well. And next, Mr. Pickersgill was at that time out of office and had some time on his hands, and he thought he could help along the work by perhaps making a preliminary narrative based on the diary for the war years. And remember, he was in Mr. King's office through the entire period of the war. Well, out of that came the set of books called The Mackenzie King Record, which is a narrative based on the diary, giving very, very large quotations from it with connecting bits of narrative with people identified and things of that kind. And for the period it covers, from the outbreak of the war in 1939 to Mr. King's retirement in the fall of 1948, it takes just over 2,000 printed pages. That gives you some idea of the extent of the diary and the enormous detail of the thing. And there is also the point that it gives you as nearly as possible Mr. King's story in his own words. That is why Mr. Pickersgill chose the title The Mackenzie King Record. Now there are two aspects of the diary that have been much in the public eye lately, owing to Colonel Stacey's book. I may say Colonel Stacey was a privileged character with regard to the diary. He was writing the official military history of the war, and as such, we felt he should be a privileged character and that he should have access to the diary, and he should have access to Mr. King's set of the war cabinet minutes, and so on and so on. So that he had a pretty good knowledge of the diary before he started on this volume, which you've all seen probably, called A Very Double Life. And it is concerned primarily with Mr. King's relations with women and with his addiction to spiritualism. Now, so far as the ladies are concerned, they fall definitely into two groups. The lower class ones, shall we say, and the upper class ones. And so far as the lower class ones concerned, there's a very interesting discussion that goes on amongst people who knew Mr. King and have seen the whole diary and everything as to the extent to which he did actually consort with prostitutes and so on. I personally have very grave doubts. Ramsay Cook, in a review of the book, I think, put it quite nicely. He said, "Some of the evidence seems less conclusive to me than to Stacey. King may have succumbed to the charms of some of these girls. The difficulty is," and I like this bit, "the language of the diary is never explicit." And that's quite true. Even Professor Ayers, Jim Ayers, now a professor at York University, who is anything but friendly to King, has grave doubts as to whether Mr. King, I think he would say he grave doubts if Mr. King had the courage, you see. But anyway, whatever the basis for his doubts, he has grave doubts. And I think, just for my opinion, I think those grave doubts are very, very pretty well founded. King was a highly emotional person. He was following in Gladstone's steps a bit. He was out to save the girls from the street. He was out on rescue missions and everything. And the Gladstone Diary is being published verbatim, and it has as many surprises in it in that respect as Mr. King's diary. And yet, I don't think anyone has actually accused Mr. Gladstone of succumbing to the allures of the ladies, and I would certainly dislike to accuse Mr. King of anything of the kind. Now, so far as spiritualism is concerned, there's evidence that Mr. King, over a long period of time, had an interest in spiritualism. It came basically, I think, from his absolute and utter belief that there was a spiritual world in which the dead were living and in which the dead were conscious of what was going on in the physical world of the present day. He was lonely. He longed for the association of father, particularly his mother, a brother to whom he'd been greatly attached, and so on. It was a question of communication. He was always wondering, was there a possibility of establishing communication? And when he was out of office and had time, he began to toy with spiritualism in a more serious way. This first came to public notice, by the way, when a medium in London, Geraldine Cummins, proposed to publish her reminiscences. In some way, the word got back to Canada that she was going to tell all and tell about the seances she had had with Mackenzie King. Up to that time, I don't think a word had appeared in public about this. And amongst many of Mr. King's friends, this was regarded as a very dreadful thing indeed. And Leonard Brockington was going to England at the time, and they appealed to Brockington. Brock, can't you do something? Can't you do something about this dreadful woman who's going to publish this? So off Brock went to London, and he interviewed Geraldine Cummins, and he discovered, I saw her in a television interview and read various letters and that, she was completely convinced, she was a completely honest woman, she was completely convinced that she had these special powers, that the messages she got were perfectly genuine. There was nothing false about it from the point of Geraldine Cummins. I'm quite convinced of that. But she was going to publish this. And she flatly refused to omit reference to Mr. King or anything of the kind. And I remember Brock came home and he said, never in his life had he had a greater desire to strike a happy medium. Brock was a marvelous character, a wonderful orator, a fine writer. During the war, he used to write speeches for Mr. King sometimes, and Mr. King always went through and cut out the purple patches. And Brock would say, but Mr. King, you cut out the finest patches, the purple patches. And Mr. King is alleged to have said to him, yes, Mr. Brockington, but the trouble is people remember purple patches. So on. Anyway, the Geraldine Cummins book came out, and the spiritualism came out in the open. Now, the spiritualism took various forms. It took visits to mediums, table rapping, Ouija boards, so on. Also, dreams had a certain element here. Mr. King took great notes of his dreams, and he felt they had significance, and so on and so on. They were perhaps a means, an unrecognized means of communication, and so on. And he really, while he was out of office, between 1930 and 1935, quite a bit of time was devoted to spiritualism at that time. I think one of the first things that shook him, perhaps, was the matter of the honors that Mr. Bennett the night goods that Mr. Bennett proposed to give in 1935. Mr. King thought he'd like to know who was going to get them, so he consulted Sir Wilfrid Laurier and various other people by means of the mediums. And he got a list, and the list proved to be completely wrong. And this shook his faith in the prophetic angle of spiritualism. Then, when he returned to office in 1935, he was far too busy to be bothered. And although occasionally he did indulge a little bit thereafter, it was a very unimportant part thereafter. Now, the main thing that people wonder about, did Mackenzie King run the country with advice from mediums? And that is completely untrue. And everyone who has looked into this matter agrees that it's true. It was a compartment. It had nothing whatever to do with his conduct of private affairs. Even his severest critics will poke fun at him about his spiritualism, but they will never say that he in any way was guided by it or ran the country by it or anything of that kind. That is just not so. Now, I think a word has to be said about one or two women friends that Mr. King had that meant a very great deal to him. The two that meant most, I never knew them well at all, but I met them both. One was Violet Markham, who her married name was Mrs. Carruthers, who lived in England and met Mr. King when he was well, 1905, when he was Deputy Minister of Labour at a reception at Government House in Ottawa. She was out visiting at Government House. And she took an interest in him, and she helped him financially thereafter at various times. She sent him money for his election campaign in 1911, when he was defeated, and she thought he might be hard up and have difficulties getting along. She sent him an allowance for 3 years. She wrote and said, "Now, Rex," she always called him Rex, as most of his intimate friends did, "Rex, you may need some help, and I'll be pleased to send you a certain sum during the next 3 years just to help you along." She was a remarkable woman, very interested in public affairs, very interested in social progress and so on, and they had a long personal correspondence. They met fairly frequently, and they were very good friends. The other one was Mrs. Joan Patterson, and Mrs. Patterson was a personal friend in quite a different way. She was quiet, she was a good listener, she was sympathetic, she was reassuring. When Mr. King was downhearted, she could cheer him up. She was always ready to listen and give him a sympathetic ear. Mr. King was essentially a lonely man. I discovered that very quickly when I was dealing with him. He wasn't married. He had no immediate family anywhere near him, especially when he was out of office and was not submerged in public affairs. He was very, very lonely indeed, and would frequently be quite depressed. And Joan Patterson, through many years, was the person to whom he turned, and she was always there and always sympathetic and always ready to listen and to help. A very charming woman that I met once or twice. Incidentally, I asked her one day about the famous ruins of Kingsmere. And I said, "Mrs. Patterson, how did the ruins of Kingsmere come into existence, the romantic ruins on the estate there?" And she said, "Well, of course, it didn't start as ruins at all. Mr. King was going along one day and he saw a building being demolished, and there was a very fine stone window, bay window. And he decided that would be a very nice window to have in a new library he was thinking of building in Kingsmere. So he bought it and had it moved out and put up. And when they got that far, they discovered that the ground behind it was solid rock and that it was just not feasible to build there. So for a while, the, the ruined, the window just stood there. And then suddenly he began to think, this looks kind of romantic, you know, that ruin up on the hill. And away he went and began to add other ruins, including bits of the Parliament buildings from London and so on and so on. That's the origin of the ruins. Now, looking over this whole picture, the diaries, the fact that they're open. By the way, Professor Ayers has accused the literary executives of sundry things. He says, "Why didn't we make them available?" They are available. Diaries from 1893 to 1931 in toto have been published on microfiche by the University of Toronto Press. Anybody can buy a copy. The diary beyond that date has been opened in accordance with the 30-year rule, access rule, which governs government documents, which means that the diaries up to 1948, in other words, to the end of the war, are now available to anybody who wants to go and look at them in the Public Archives of Canada. I don't know how much more open you can make them than that. Now, we realize that making them, and we've had experience in various articles and books and so on, opening them has exposed him to belittlement. People can poke fun at him, even ridicule. But he emerges as, through it all as a fascinating personality. And once again, I go back to Colonel Stacey's words. They give you a very intimate and tremendously detailed picture of the operations of a political leader whose efficiency was unparalleled in Canadian, and Colonel Stacey adds, perhaps in modern history. He towers above his personal peculiarities. All of us have them. I met Violet Markham in Scotland, in Edinburgh, or near Edinburgh, a few months after Mr. King's death. And we talked about the biography. And the last thing Violet Markham, I always remember this, she was going to a building and I was going down the steps. And she turned at the top of the steps and she turned, "Now remember, you must portray Rex, warts and all." Well, I think, isn't that just what we've done? And in the total picture, it seems to me that the warts are not a terribly important part of the portrait.
I've explained to Dr. Lamb that our custom here is to have a question period, and he's ready to and willing to answer all your attacks.
Try to answer.
Yes?
The diaries were so very long. As one of the executors, were you aware in the early years after Mackenzie King died of the number of warts that were exhibited in the diaries? Had you actually had the patience?
To start with, I depended for my knowledge on that on Fred McGregor, who had access to them. He had worked for 18 months with Mr. King from the beginning of 19, just when I got to Ottawa, beginning of 1949 until his death in 1950. He had been through a lot of the early diaries working with Mr. King. And he told me a little bit on the side. I did not actually see or handle the diaries myself until after Mr. King's death. Although I that's not quite true. I'd seen sections of the diaries of the war period, but I'd not seen the early ones until after his death.
But at that time you read them.
There are 25,000 pages. Nobody has read them all, not even Colonel Stacey. Yes?
Dr. Lamb, did you ever have occasion to speak with Mr. King about his ideas on spiritualism? Did you ever get to that?
No. No, no. No. This is a question of whether I ever had occasion to discuss spiritualism with Mr. Keene. The point was that I was aware of it, and a good many people were aware of it, but it was not public until sometime after his death, not till Geraldine Cummings was publishing her reminiscences, and then it came out in the public. Yes.
It strikes me as a very hard decision that he had to make about the diaries, knowing that he didn't wish them to be published, and there were things in there which none of us would like other people to read about. Mm-hmm. Evelyn Waugh's diaries, the same things happened with them recently. I wondered whether you talked about the possibility that that would discourage other people from keeping diaries, and that increasingly that was going to become a problem. I'm interested in the discussions that you had before you about that question. It just strikes me as a very difficult question.
I think everybody, the question is, would the fact that these diaries were being made available, as Evelyn Waugh's diaries are made available, Hans Christian Andersen is another instance, there's been 50 years of Hans Christian Andersen diaries have just been published. And it's interesting, by the way, that Hans Christian Andersen in his last years went through this same tug, should they be destroyed or not. Incidentally, I'm fairly well convinced that Mr. Keene would not have put in the provision about destruction if it hadn't been for an unfortunate circumstance. When Mr. Keene retired, John D. Rockefeller Jr., who was a great friend of his, gave him $100,000 as a gift, and later he added another $100,000 to help with the expense of preparing the memoirs, which of course was the funds that we could use for the biography. But there was always, I never saw the correspondence, and this may have been done verbally on the telephone, but there was always the suggestion that Mr. Rockefeller had tried to make the acceptance of the gift dependent on preservation of the diaries. And that was not something you did with Mr. Keene. Mr. Keene wants to be he wanted to make his own decisions. He was not going to be pressured on the subject. And I think that was an out. And also, of course, none of us ever expects to die. He thought that he had all the time in the world. He would go through the diaries and he would note what he wanted taken, and of course he never did it. And we knew he would never do it. But I think that proviso that for allowing passages to be kept and used was the result of my conversation with him. And there's one other point. As literary executors, we naturally wanted to be sure what our legal standing was in this. And we took legal advice on this, and we were told that the wording of the will was such that actually it left us complete discretion. We were not actually duty-bound to destroy anything. As he had not indicated, any passage might be something he might have indicated. Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. As a matter of fact, I think it would have been far more difficult if the microfilm copies hadn't got out. But you couldn't take the risk of destroying diaries and having someone else have copies that they might use in a totally unscrupulous way by forging extracts and so on.
When do the executor's responsibilities come to an end? Has someone replaced Norman Rockefeller?
Yes.
And
yes.
How
yes.
Do you still need them to operate?
Yes, yes. This is a question as to what becomes the literary executors. Yes. And
it might be interesting to note the same arrangement was made with respect to the trustees of his scholarship fund. They're a self-perpetuating body.
Yes. Yes. Dr. McKenzie has just told me that the trustees that were set up for the scholarship fund that was to be established with the residue of Mr. Keene's estate has a similar provision for the board of trustees replacing trustees that drop out and continuing. You have something that continues. We have something that's going to come to an end. Yes. Leonard Brockington was one, wasn't he? Yes. Yes. Of course, they're both gone, yes.
John Deutsch was standing in the wings.
Yes. too bad. Yes.
How much reference is there in Mr. King's diaries to companionship with animals as an alleviation of his loneliness?
He was terribly sentimentally attached to his dogs. There were three successive pets, the little terriers. And there's a scene that Colonel Stacy quotes a good deal of it, when one of the dogs was dying, and Mr. King singing to it and sitting up with it and so on and so on. He was terribly emotionally involved with them, and they were a straight substitute for someone. I'm quite sure you're quite right. Yes.
You describe Stacy as perhaps the best historian in Canada. And then you went on to say, as I understood it, that you didn't believe his particular interpretation of King's double life.
Yes.
Kindly reconcile this.
The question is, if I think Colonel Stacy is perhaps the best historian in the country, why is it I won't take his word about the fair ladies? There is always historical evidence upon which two opinions, people of equal status or anything else, and there is a prejudice here. Colonel Stacy did not like Mr. King. And through the years, I've been distressed. He was scrupulously fair to him when he was writing the war histories, but as he worked with his papers and worked with his diaries, he began to dislike him intensely. And this came up. I teased him once or twice about it, but I think he'd like to believe the worst. Put it that way, and I think that's probably the reason. But I watched a great many historians at work, and I know no more careful scholar than Charles Stacy. Yes?
I don't think there's any evidence that any historian anywhere is completely free from bias.
That is quite true. There is no historian anywhere completely free from bias.
Do you think there's any chance that the literary executor of Emily Carr may have changed when he became literary executor?
What was that now?
You think that the literary executor of Emily Carr, who
yes,
was talking about it in the 30s, perhaps was a different person from the literary executor of Mackenzie King, in line with what you said about somebody else in the historical.
Yes, possibly. Possibly. Yes. Well, it was an extraordinary will. By the way, he quite astonished me. This would be in 1949, along in 1949. He asked me to go up to Laurier House one afternoon. We sat down on either side of the fire, as usual. And he said, I'm going to read you my will, just like that. There are certain sections he left out. But the will left relatively small bequests to family and friends and staff, and then the whole of the rest of it went one way or another to the people of Canada. The Kingsmere Estate, the Laurier House, and with Laurier House went the $225,000 that he had been given by friends to help him support Laurier House. He practically returned everything he had got to one way or another to the people of this country.
I think that we perhaps exhausted our speaker.
And I just...
Thank you.
I should say, Dr. Lamb, that surely you yourself have pointed to another similarity with the Pepys diary. wasn't Mr. Pepys very reticent but not very explicit when he talked about the ladies too? I'm going to ask Dr. Jeffrey.
If I may, yes. He's a little more explicit in the latest edition.
I'm going to ask Dr. Jeffrey Andrews to give our thanks to the speaker. But before I do, may I remind you about the speech for next week. Dr. Jansen, who is our guest, Professor Jansen, who is our guest next week, is one of the leading art historians in the world. And I'm sure you'll be very interested in hearing what he has to say, and I hope you will all come again. Dr. Andrews?
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's always a special privilege to hear history from one of the participants. And it's a keen pleasure to hear it from one who is himself pretty objective about this. And one of the things that I always enjoy very much about Kay Lamb's recital of those historical enthusiasms to which he's subject, like CPR or boats and so on, is that he combines a great deal of historical insight with a great capacity for enjoying the human drama. And I think we've had a feast of reason and flow of soul of both kinds tonight, and for that, I know you will join me in thanking him very much. Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned.